Welcome to Artery with Robert Simpkins and Isa Kavegia, a podcast on art, authorship, and anthropology. In season three of this collaborative podcast, one anthropologist specializing in a particular cultural context has a conversation with an artist of their choosing, exploring issues of voice and authorship in art. In this episode, Rotem Steinbock, a PhD candidate in the Department of Social Anthropology at the University of Cambridge, speaks with Berlin-based artist Ayala Gazit, who specializes in photography and installation.
Hi, and welcome to this conversation between myself, Rotem Steinbock, and artist Ayala Gazit. To briefly introduce myself, I am a PhD candidate at the Department of Social Anthropology at Cambridge University, and my research follows Jewish-Israeli artists who immigrated to Berlin. Ayala Gazit is a fantastic artist specializing in photography. She was born in Israel and studied in the School of Visual Arts in New York. She graduated with honors and has since been the recipient of numerous awards, such as the Tierney Fellowship and the Photography Now Award at Woodstock, New York, amongst others. She lived in New York for 11 years before she moved to Berlin in 2016 and has been living and working there since. I got to know Ayala and her wonderful works in 2021 during my fieldwork here in Berlin. Hi, Ayala.
Hi, Rotem.
Could you please tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure, gladly. So I'm originally from Israel, as you said, and I had a long stretch of living in New York, as you said. And I've been living in Berlin now for over 7 years. That's, you know, you just gave my trajectory, but I think that's pretty much sums me up as a person, but also as an artist. So, that's me in a nutshell. Right now, I also have a small child that's yes. Also part of life.
You're an artist and a mother.
And a mother, proudly. So that also is part of living in Berlin right now, is raising a child, also in German. So that's also something that I feel like I should mention as part of our day. That's me in a little bit.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here today with you.
Me too.
It's been wonderful to see you after so long.
So
many months has passed.
So much of life has happened.
Yeah. I wanted to talk with you today about two works in specific. Your work, Alte Sachen, mm-hmm. Which means old things, both in German and in Yiddish. Mm-hmm. And your work, You Don't Say. Mm-hmm. You Don't Say was created in New York, mm-hmm. and Alte Sachen was created
in Berlin.
Yep. Yes. So can you tell me about this work?
Sure. Let me start let's do it chronologically. You Don't Say was my first real project. I did it as my senior year project in SBA. And what that really was me trying to figure out, how am I a German citizen? That's where it started. Mm-hmm. My father did all the paperwork for me becoming a German citizen, but it was all because my grandfather, who I never met, flee Germany in 1936 on his own and went to Palestine with a violin. And that's sort of all I knew. But it all started from this very kind of I couldn't really figure out what the story was in our journey from being a German family to being an Israeli family. And so I never met my grandfather, but my grandmother was alive, and she was a librarian, and everything was very organized. And I asked my dad, I was like, so wait, who is your grandmother? And he's like, I don't know, her name was Paulina, ask your grandmother. So I said to my grandmother, I'm like, so do you have any pictures of Paulina? And she's like, who's Paulina? And I was like, isn't she your mother-in-law? She's like, oh, you mean Adolfina? I'm like, that's a name? So finding out that I'm a descendant of a woman named Adolfina was really what sparked it for me, is this complex identity as my German heritage. So, and then the more I met family members and I took my recorder and I recorded conversations, also because I don't trust myself from remembering details, but mainly because I wanted to keep this momentum going when people are remembering things. And I could find that stories were clashing. Like, some people remembered this, this other person was a secret, this, they didn't know about this brother, they didn't know about that person. And then the recording started with asking specific questions, but then it sort of allowed people to tell me their deepest and darkest and stories of pain and stories of longing and betrayal and all these different stories, which I felt sort of stepped away from the German identity or Jewish identity story, but was more about every family. Every family has a story that's under the carpet. Every family has something that you don't say, right? So I felt like it was sort of like a pun, you know, you don't say these stories. Yes. And I'm just kind of like, okay, so that was swept under the carpet. Let me just lift the carpet and let's talk about what's under here. And I did that with my 90-year-old grandmother. And
you interviewed her, right?
Oh, yeah. Many, many a times. Wow. And I recorded conversations with her. And the first conversation I recorded with her, she said everything. I thought she was going to lie. My cousin told me she was going to lie about certain facts, and she didn't lie. And she sort of saw this as an opportunity to have her angle of any story be documented. And you can see that that is something that people really appreciate when they're being listened and and sort of validated. And then with time, I started noticing that I don't have facts. I have memories and opinions. And that's sort of, to me, what history turns into, because you don't have those facts, what actually happened and what, you know, it's not clear. It's all about perspective. And I started going in this circle. And the person I collaborated on this project the most was my father, who also enjoyed the things I was finding. And and he was my collaborator for many years based on this dialogue. So I recorded conversations with him, and I recorded, I really just traveled and recorded. I went to Oxford to meet the youngest sibling of my grandfather to find out what happened there. And I just sort of showed up with cameras and a recorder and hoped for the best.
And people collaborated.
And they did. They did because they wanted to be remembered from what they, their experience was. And I gave them a stage for that, which was not also, I wasn't judging. I had no, you know, because I'm, you know, remote and generation wise, I wasn't traumatized by anything that they went through. And I was just curious. So I think that naive, I don't like the word naive, but that pure curiosity was very inviting for them.
What did you end up doing with the text of the interviews and the images?
So I ended up using a combination of things. I made a family album, like an alternative family album. And most of my work is sort of that kind of concept where I appropriate found images that that I found in my family archives. And because I can't photograph these certain people. And then I also combined images that I took sometimes within the exact context and location, like a documentary, but also sometimes not, and kept it sort of open. And that's where it sort of enters the fine art world rather than enters the documentary world. And when you step into that, the second kind of realm of fine arts, where you become an artist and not a documentarian, that is a different, that's a different approach. So I was really kind of dancing between those two, and I still am, but in the sense where I'm not telling the exact story, because I don't have all the facts. So who am I to do that?
It's also the awareness of not having,
having and accepting that.
Yes.
And
taking that as the baseline for the creation.
Exactly. So I think when I accepted that, it was, and also again, with my father collaborating with me, and my father was a theater director and a theater professor, and a lot of what he sort of embedded within my way of thinking was that you have to constantly do something that is the most personal, that will help, that will hit the universal. So how is it personal, universal, simultaneously? How do you balance that?
That's so interesting.
So because it can't be, I also, with everything that I do, is very diaristic, and I don't want it to be like a diary entry that I'm asking for sympathy, empathy, pity, whatever. That's not what I want. I want strangers, complete strangers, to feel something that they already feel, and that it sparked something within them. And that is how it becomes universal. So how do you hint on that? And it's hinting, and it's not saying. So it's sort of provoking emotions and creating kind of an openness. Also with the text was sentences that popped out for me. from conversations. I don't give the whole conversation. I just give the sentence that could be understood in many different ways, and have that sort of be an entry for a viewer. Also, the way I installed the exhibition was the idea of the viewers are coming into a grandmother's home. You know what I mean? Or Like, they have to be active here. They have to piece their own pieces together. I'm giving them a puzzle. Figure it out yourself. You can make any shape you want out of this. And I don't mind that you decontextualize my grandmother, because I'm not giving you her. I'm giving you an image of her that I took. So there's something about that going back and forth. And the editing process for this work is very long.
Yes.
So it's like a puzzle.
I'm thinking about how your viewer is going through a similar process to what you went through, mm-hmm. because you were a little bit of a detective.
Exactly.
With your own family story, and mm-hmm. they're entering the space and also need to explore.
Exactly. And that to me felt like the only thing I can actually stand behind. I can't stand behind the facts because I don't know them. But I can stand behind the experience. Yes. and convey that experience to others. That is the only thing I can 100% be. That's what I did. That's my voice per se, or that's my authorship of this experience and how I would like somebody else to have that. And I'm not dictating this is how you should feel at this point. No, you want to cry from that one. You want to laugh from this one. You do you. But whatever that is an active viewing experience, which I find a lot more interesting than not.
Yes. I wanted to ask you about this because you collaborated with your father. You also interviewed family members. And in another piece, Alte Sachen, you collaborated mm-hmm. With the video artist Itamar Inbar.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you, when you make art in collaboration, mm-hmm. how do you decide authorship?
It's a great question. I think it's different when comparing the two. Like, my father was never there was never a status of collaborator. He was also the subject. He was also a voice I was guided by, but also he was a voice within the story. And projects that I did after that as well with him. When it came to Itamar Inbal, it was a literal collaboration. Like, it was yes. two artists working together.
Maybe you can also tell us a little bit about Alte Sachen before we
let me explain that. Yeah. So Alte Sachen is a collaboration again with Itamar Inbal, and it was exhibited in a project space in Prenzlauer called TET in 2018. I was a member of the project space, so I had the opportunity to do whatever I wanted as long as it had to do with art. And
Great.
It's amazing. And I already worked with Itamar on a different exhibition, and I love the way he thinks, and I still do. And I love his technical abilities as well. He's self-taught, and he's incredible and not intimidated by technology at all, unlike myself.
Yes.
So,
and myself.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just like, oh my God, what are you? And he's like, oh, I figured it out already. So there were many things that were very similar about in the way we think. We even share a birthday, but there's there's so many things that were very, very different. And something about that relationship was very freeing in many ways, because somebody else has their strengths and here's mine. So at first I wanted to give him the opportunity to have a space and you do whatever you want to do. Yes. And I'll produce the event and I'll get the people and I'll do the cards and the bar and the whatever. And he's like, no, let's do this together. And I was like, mm-hmm. Uh-oh, what do you mean? So we started, this was a long collaboration, and we started a ping pong game, and he initiated it, where he said, look at pictures that you took that you were willing to let me sort of play with. Cut them up, turn them into something else. What could you let go of?
Yes.
And that was a really interesting exercise for me.
A difficult question maybe in itself.
Yeah.
What can I let go of?
What can I let go of? And especially when you, I'm also a lot in my work is a lot of analog photography, which takes so much time and focus, and the way you take the picture is specifically what you want and not open for manipulation, really. Yes. And I took the pictures within a certain context for a certain project, for a certain story. What within this could I just toss and give to somebody else to explore? And I was like, oh my God, I can't. So it took a few rounds of editing. And it's in a sense, images in which also some that I took, some that I found within my family archive, that I'm willing to give it to other hands. And I think the idea, I'm personally a control freak, so this was a very challenging exercise.
I can identify with that.
Exactly. So like lose control over everything you controlled. And he was very interesting about what he made out of them. So he cut them up and
it's
turned them
into... It's a wonderful piece. What ended up, the collaboration between you was really fruitful.
It was fruitful. It was. I'll give you that. Because what he ended up doing was taking still images and animating them and cutting them up and creating a sequence of animation that and a beat to it that was like, what are we doing? Like, where is this even going? There was no plot. There was nothing that was making this into something coherent for months.
A new story was created.
Exactly. But what are we even saying? Like, what is the story? What is the title? And what is this? So when it came to the title, we tried to think of a word that would be also in German and also in Hebrew. And then I was learning German at the time. I was going every day to German class. And then somehow somebody said Alte Sachen and just like clicked. And I was like, I never even thought of the word being in German. And for an Israeli, what Alte Sachen means, we should mention that.
Yes.
Because it's something that is in the video as well. In the end, when we made a video out of it, out of the installation, is that in Israel, there's been all the years, a man with a horse and a buggy, and he yells in a megaphone, Alte Sachen, Alte Sachen. And just what it means is if you have something to get rid of, he'll bring you to the flea market. And so you're used to hearing the horse and this chant.
And he travels inside towns and cities with the horse.
I grew up in Tel Aviv. You never think that you hear a horse in Alte Sachen, but you do. And that's always like a childhood memory thing. And then when I understood that what they were saying was Alte Sachen in the first place. I never even knew what they say.
It's difficult to hear.
Also because it's in the megaphone and you're like, what? And then I'm like, oh, it means old things. That makes complete sense. And then I'm like, these are old things that we're dealing with.
Yes.
And at the time I had my shipment of all my stuff from New York came into Berlin right when this was happening. So I was like, let's take all of my, not all, but
How did your stuff travel?
By the sea. It was a long journey.
Yes.
But I was like, oh, I have these frames. Let's appropriate the frames that were for a different show. Let's appropriate the whole story. Everything that I look at isn't what it was taken for. And sort of the practice of decontextualizing even your family pictures, even pictures of my father as a child, they're now just of a child, you know, and
it's an abstraction of some sort.
Exactly. And for me, it was very difficult to sort of let go and give all the but the whole voice just to Itamar. And then at some point when we started directing it within the space, how do we project it? Because he's very good at projection mapping as well, which I just adore.
Very
that. It's fantastic. So it just gives you this sort of freedom of, it could be anything, it could be anywhere, it could be projected from all these objects. So we started...
It's creating a new world.
Exactly. And then, so we started bringing in, and I felt like, again, like my exhibits before, where you're making the viewer come into a living environment. I was like, let's make another living environment. Let's bring a carpet, a clock, a chair, a lamp, and let's project on everything.
So your idea was to bring in all things.
All things. And it feels like a flea market, you know, like you're in a flea market of memories, of thoughts, of I don't want to say the word traumas, but also
pain and
laughter and all these different things.
Yes.
So how, and I also, there was another part of the exhibit that I wanted to incorporate the wall within the space, because the walls in that space were all like banged up and with plaster over the years. And that gave it like sort of this kind of Berlin vibe of the walls of Berlin.
Yes.
And I'm projecting this story that some of it took place in Germany, some of it took place anywhere. But the idea was to create a new story out of our old things.
Yes.
In a nutshell. I hope that answered the question.
Yes, it's so interesting. I'm wondering, what was it like for you to create this piece while living in Berlin? Maybe as opposed to creating You Don't Say while living in New York.
Well, I think... creating You Don't Say brought me to Berlin for the first time. A lot of the work within that is from that visit. And in order to, and I received the Turing Fellowship based on that work. And actually my proposal was to move to Berlin. I ended up using the fellowship for something else, but it was always, I need to get to Berlin for many, many years until I actually got here. So I always hoped to make work here, also dealing with all of these contradicting feelings and complex identities of coming where I come, we come from, and yes, being here. So I was very much hoping, I think that living in New York made me feel like the things that I want to photograph are somewhere else, regarding this work. And they're not near me. So I feel more freedom of creativity in a city like Berlin, where it allows it. It's easier to make work here.
Yes. It's interesting because it's a freedom of creativity that depends on something that happened here, something that is located, a memory that somehow is reflected in these walls in Berlin.
In Berlin. And I feel like, you know, many people that I speak to about living here and why I chose to live here and versus New York. And I love New York. Don't get me wrong. It's an amazing city. And it allows a lot, if you can. It brings you to the highest highs and the lowest lows. But it also, to me, felt, also coming from Israel, that the things I recognize in New York aren't because something happened here, rather because a scene in a movie that I love happened here.
And I need a representation.
Exactly.
Here.
Exactly. Or someone's idea of something. It's a set. And that over the years felt to me like it's a set. And I want to live in a place that is layered with history.
Yes.
For the good and bad of that. But that's something that makes me, I don't want to say feel more at home. It's not necessarily a homey feeling, but it something is more authentic that way. That was my very personal experience. Anyone can have a different experience, both in Berlin and in New York and in Israel. But to me, that was one of the things that I started feeling like Berlin will have a different, when I was hoping to get here all that time. And I think that that's what is here. It's a very layered city. And every place you go to, there's layers of history, and you can just sort of pick and choose which one you want to focus on. And even the Cold War, there's so much here that there's an abundance of it, for the good and bad of that.
Yes, that's so very interesting. I'm thinking about making art in such a layered context. Mm-hmm. And then your art also involves many different layers,
exactly.
Medium-wise, content-wise, mm-hmm. Also many voices of people that
exactly.
you incorporate into it.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, was Berlin part of your inspiration for those two pieces?
I think Germany was, for You Don't Say, for sure. Also because it was the first time I used my German passport. It was the first time all these things happened. And I think for Alte Sachen was more for, because we were both, Itamar and I are Israeli, living here. I think we were sort of, knowingly or not, we're playing with our own identity of being here and bringing our own old stuff and making a new one, knowingly or not. I think a lot of the things that need to be mentioned in the process with Itamar was, or my process generally, is very intuitive. I can't explain why this has to be there now.
Yes.
But I feel that that's where it should go. So, and then together it became something that when I look at it, I have a narrative in my mind. But it doesn't have to be projected to everybody else. But for me, it sits somewhere that I can make sense out of this. But it happens very intuitively over time. So I think that even if you ask Itamar today, we would both be like, wait, what? like what were we didn't sit and have a manifesto and talk about what the approach is as our identity. No, we're both people that love to make visuals and let's try it together. Kind of that was really where we were going. Many, many, many sessions in the studio with like, does this work? Does this not work? Let's try it on this. Let's try it on that. And you know, I'm grateful for it. That's really what I got to say.
Yes. I'm really grateful for this piece. I think as a viewer, I really feel that again, in the concept level of it, it opens up a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm.
And in the emotional level, it gives a lot of answers in the mm-hmm. sense that it makes an emotional sense.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm glad to hear that. It sounds lovely. But yeah, it's not.
Yes.
It's, yeah.
I wanted to ask you, this season is devoted to the notion of voice, and you mentioned voice in such many different really interesting ways. I wanted to ask about voice in these two works, and what was really interesting to me is that you also give voice to others. There's your voice as an author, and also the voices of the family members you interviewed, and the voice of images that you use from the family archives. And you write in the description of the piece that by creating this world, you also give all things, and I'm talking about Alte Sachen, you give all things a new home. So I was wondering about the experience of making art that gives voices from the past a place in the present.
I think in a nutshell, maybe except one of my projects, it all has to do with things in the past that I can't get to, or people I can't meet. So how do you photograph someone you're never going to meet? Or how do you, you know, those kind of conceptual problems. And I think that when it came to giving a voice, I think with You Don't Say specifically, I was giving a voice. I gave a quote, but I didn't say who said it, you know? And many times I put it next to the person that said it, or maybe next to their legs, or next to the representation of maybe if I would have photographed that woman, those would be her shoes. You know what I mean? Because I can't photograph a woman that isn't with us from before I was born. So it's almost like an imaginary game where you're giving a sentence that you know is, I know who said it. I know in what context. I'm not taking it out of the context. I'm giving a type of context, but I'm keeping it sort of open for that sentence to get any voice in any family.
You know, you're letting the voice travel.
Exactly.
Within a specific system.
Yeah, in a sense, I guess that's true. So I think in that one was for me also to take the sentences out of the context of a long conversation. I would sit and listen to them and just write sentences and then have it on post-its on my wall and start playing. This works here. This works there. This should be. Is this too much? Is this too little? Is this, you know, so the editing process needs to be mentioned, where I think that's most of the work, where I can't say most, but a lot of it, where in some of my projects, I lived with it on my walls for months. And it was kind of,
what an experience.
Yeah. You look
as a viewer, you can't imagine
that is how it works even, you know? Yes, so it's like exactly. From the floor to the ceiling, post-its everywhere. And until it started getting a shape, and every time I recommend it to, if I talk to students or other photographers, where I think for me, it's been the most useful way of editing, where you're used to the digital realm and you can just move to the next picture and click and you're not there. But if you have to edit it down to a certain amount, or you're making a book or making an exhibition, it has to be, to me anyway, I could look at the same picture over time, and then after a while, it's no longer a picture of my father, my mother, my sister, whoever, or me even. It's a picture of a person. Now, is it a good picture? Like you let go of that personal connection that you have, and you should have always and forever. But if you're using it in this context that you're sending it out to the world, and you're not going to be there to explain, then does it still stand? Is it still a good portrait, or is it still a good still life image, whatever it is? That's the way I edit. I look at it over time. And then I'm like, and then they come off the wall. And I used to write notes on them. I used to crop them manually, all these different things where it was pieces of a puzzle. And then over time they would have a sequence, and suddenly they turned into pages, and then they're a book.
That's so interesting, because I'm thinking about how you start making your piece with a very specific voice, and actually what the goal that you set yourself as an artist is to make that voice speak to many, many others, to everyone.
Yeah. I think it should be to anyone. It doesn't have to be anybody that speaks your language or read a book about anything. You know what I mean? Like I find it frustrating when I go to an exhibition where I'm like, oh, I didn't read that book to understand what I'm looking at. No, I'm supposed to be a person off the street and I need to feel something. That's the way I see art. But that's my personal perspective. You could be a very, you know, intellectual way of working and research and all these things. But if I don't feel anything from this, then I don't feel anything from this. And that's sort of where my interest lies. But that's a very specific way of thinking and working and being. You know, that's just how I find it interesting. And I think it's, but, and this stands for any type of art. This can be anything. It doesn't have to be photography. It doesn't have to be documentary. It could be dance. It could be anything. So when it works, it works.
Yes. I wanted to ask you, do you remember when you started to consider yourself as an artist? Was there a particular moment or time that played a major role for you in becoming an artist?
I was always a photographer. And that was from the age of like 15. And I knew that this is an art form. So I treated it as an art form. And I knew that from the beginning that I always wanted to be creative somehow. I come from a creative family, but I couldn't, my family's from the theater, so I couldn't be on a stage and have all these people look at me. But I was just like...
You wanted to look at others.
Yeah, and I wanted to be invisible. So that is the camera for you. And I think over the years, speaking of voice, I noticed that my role is, and that was very difficult for me to accept. I don't know if I'm answering your question, but it was very difficult for me to accept the fact that my voice is the one telling the story. And I need to stand behind it. And I always was like, no, everybody else. And I'm just here to document.
But maybe you're standing behind the camera, but you're talking through it.
Exactly. And something about accepting that, and my father really helped me with accepting that, and with coming to terms with the fact that if I didn't come with my camera and record it, so the story didn't happen, this specific story, and whichever one out of all the projects. If I don't do it, then it's not there. Then I better be okay with my own voice and not hide, because there's something with photographers that also deal with, that people don't talk about, is deal with shape-shifting. And any person that documents has to shape-shift to the scenario that you're in order to make people feel comfortable. And I'm not saying lie. I'm just saying you adapt. Maybe shape-shifting is more adapting into the context and what it calls for. But
in a way, it's similar to the work of the ethnographer.
Exactly. So you need to allow and you need to enable other people to feel comfortable to express. And but what do you do with all that?
Be able to be present in many different ways because people are different.
Exactly. So each person, I keep saying exactly, each person.
Because we agree.
Yeah, exactly. But each person calls for something else. And in order to, I felt like over the years, I was getting lost within all my shape-shifting, you know, because I was like, what is my voice? Do I even have an opinion? What's my favorite food? I don't even remember who I am. So you get into this kind of realm of, I forgot already.
Yes. And everything is a
representation.
Yeah, representation of
exactly
things.
Exactly. So so I do think that finding one's voice, it's sort of a, it feels to me like a slogan or like sentence, like you have to find your voice and you have to, I think the voice comes with making, you know, through making you find your opinion, you find who you are within it. And then when you show work and then you're asked questions, not necessarily like this, but even in an exhibit, you have to explain why you did what you did. You know, you have to know why. And even if you don't, as you're making it up, you're like, I guess that's what it is. You know, like, so you see people sort of wing it, but you also see people that have a specific agenda. And to me, it feels always has been intuitive and always has been the more honest I am, the stronger it is, the stronger the what I am receiving from another person that I'm photographing or documenting. So it's a dialogue. It's never really a monologue. And as hard it is for me to hear my own voice in a recording, it's always like,
I can't identify.
Exactly. I just can't handle it. But the amount that I had to listen to myself say, I'm like, why'd you say that? But it was who I was in that moment, and I just have to accept it. So
yes, exactly.
And that's sort of what it is. And I think I don't have an epiphany moment in which I was like, I am an artist. No, but I was and still probably am a very curious person. And I allowed in my earlier years of school and after to allow my curiosity to take me as far as it could. And I think
I love that.
I think that's just what it is. Like, and I think that being an artist and being a viewer, you have to be curious. And I think that should be the strongest suit. And whatever you grasp, whatever you manage to collect into your bag of treasures along the way, great. But it's always, to me, it was always a journey that I don't know what it's going to look like. Where am I going? How, you know, I'm getting on a flight to places I've never been to, you know, and hoping for the best. But, yes. And most of the time, if not all of the time, being pleasantly surprised by the warmth of people and the openness of people that were strangers and now I consider family.
Yes.
So I've been very fortunate with that. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Because so I just went like, boom.
It's so interesting. And I'm also thinking about how you talked about your own voice directing you in making a piece or in a certain approach to the materials that you're dealing with. I was wondering if making a piece also changes you back.
Yeah.
So affects the way you see yourself or behave.
Absolutely. I think that every project that I've done has changed me one way or another and has formed me into who I am for the good and bad of that. Again, imagine any journey. It doesn't even have to be something that you come out with a piece from it. Just any journey as a human, you go to places you've never been to ask questions you might not have answers for, and you come back different. You just come back and you have to be open for that. And I was shocked by it in the beginning.
Yes.
But over time, I understood that that's just, it's sort of also the process of being a person, but that does things and meets people and is open to change. But
yes.
It always brought me to surprising places also within myself that I would be surprised that I managed,
yes.
You know, like I came back. What? And I think photographing also, just as a side note, is a survival mechanism for me.
That's so interesting.
For any, cause it also allows you to, for lack of a better word, disconnect from the grandeur of a situation and know that to document it and give it a space in memory, will allow me to process it at a later date.
Yes.
So I'll photograph it. People will be surprised. Why are you photographing this right now?
Yes.
But it's my way of dealing.
You know, and I think this is the time to also
bring it up.
Yeah, to bring up the fact that we're meeting in a week when there's a very tragic war in Israel and in Palestine.
Yes.
And I'm actually meeting you 2 days after arriving back to Berlin.
Yeah, I don't even remember. I lost track of that.
Yes, so you were in Israel while
when it started. Yeah.
Yes, and traveled back here. I mean, first I will just ask you, how are you feeling?
Confused. I'm grateful to be okay. I'm grateful everyone's okay and no one's okay. But that I...
In your family, everyone is safe.
Yeah,
right,
yeah. Safer than others. I think we're in a collective state of shock. I think that would be it.
Yes.
As an Israeli, I'm saying this, that it's a blow to the system that in our generation, we've never had this.
Yes.
So I think we're all in a state of, honestly, shock. And I think from my experience with dealing with shock when something bad happens, I'm feeling symptoms that are the same. And I'm allowing them to happen. I'm not, I'm hoping that I can manage to keep this up. But finding a way where I want to hear other people's perspective. I want to hear...
Yes.
Not only Israelis and their perspective. I personally am very torn by this from many angles. Every time there was a war, even since I'm a kid, I've always thought of the kids on the other side. And that didn't change now either. So I think if it didn't change now, it's never going to change. And I'm accepting the fact that I might be naive, but empathy is still something that's in my body, which I'm grateful for.
Yes.
But it's a horrible time. Also to have a kid that you want to keep safe and want to keep that bubble of pure curiosity and thrill and learning about the world and keep that almost like a facade to keep it up. And that's what we were doing when we were there. And I felt like we were all shocked in our own ways and all mourning many things, not only even people that I don't know, and hopefully there won't be people that I know amongst these
the victims
or the kidnapped or any of this. And even if I knew, it doesn't matter. It's a national shock.
Yes.
And I'm just I don't think any of us are okay that come from that area of the world. Even if you're Palestinian, you're not okay right now.
Yes.
And I'm nervous. I don't know if nervous is the word. I'm uneasy about the idea that if you say one thing, it means something else about the other side. This whole thing of the other that was
the idea of sides.
The idea of sides. The idea of it's not just people across the board, just people. And civilians are civilians and all this. But I'm taking a step down from trying to explain this to people because I don't know how I feel yet. And I think it's slowly trickling down, these moments of recognition of what happened and what is happening. Yes. And it's too big to grasp. And I feel like
we're talking about it so soon after it happened.
Yeah,
as it is still
happening. Still happening, and it's a war, and I don't know. I felt to me while we were in Israel, I felt that we were all sort of in a state of mourning, of like sitting Shiva for people that are the people that are not here anymore. Also ideas of being, feeling safe, ideas of feeling strong, ideas of this will never happen to us again, all these slogans. So it's a lot of, it's a drawing experience. And you're constantly comparing yourself to everyone. Well, yeah, but nothing happened to me. So I don't get to say anything. And I think everyone needs to have
The space
and the freedom to feel what they feel and go through those feelings, because otherwise we're not going to make it to the other end of anything. But there's nothing good to say about this. There's nothing right. And this conflict is obviously never ending. And I hope that one day will come to an end, but I don't.
I hope that one day we will listen to this episode and say, oh, wow, it did end.
It did end. Yeah, that would be lovely. Yes. That would be lovely. And I want to believe also for our kids that this will not go on forever, and it won't be more and more generations of trauma and hurt and death. It's a very insecure time.
Yes.
I think that's what would sum it up as an adjective.
Yes.
We don't feel strong. No one feels strong.
I'm thinking about how art can come into this right now. What are your thoughts about taking this to some place of creation?
I would like to, I don't know if I should say this out loud, so then I'm really obligated to do something.
You can change your mind.
I'm going to change my mind, but I would like to document other people here in Berlin that are experiencing a variety of feelings. And by doing so, sort of legitimizing my feelings as well. Or understanding, not legitimizing, understanding my own, because I don't understand what I'm feeling. I know I feel a heavy weight on my heart and sadness and pain. And I randomly burst out crying. I randomly feel like I lost my knees. That happened the first night. I fell. I just couldn't stand up suddenly. And yes. It was too big to grasp. And I feel like now that we're not in Israel, and it's not around us. Everybody around us is very much aware of the situation. Here, you're amongst foreigners as well. And it can create, provoke loneliness. And I want to burst that bubble of potential loneliness by enabling dialogue with other, if it's mothers, if it's father, if it's anything, really, people that are here. And maybe through those dialogues, something creative could happen.
I think this has been your way of working.
Yeah.
And it really turned out to be something that gives security in a different sense.
Yeah. I hope. I think it's, yeah. I don't even know if it's security, but it gives, again, the word, the voice. It gives a voice for people that right now need to be heard. Even if it's nothing's going to happen from it, a coffee with another person that is feeling all these feelings and needs to be heard. I'm here to listen. I'm also here to talk, to understand it together. So I think something, and I'm not a therapist, I have no degrees in any of this, but I feel like an empathetic conversation can service a lot. And a lot of my work anyway, from putting myself under the category of the artist right now, a lot of my work has to do with pain and loss and longing.
Yes.
And fear and all these different emotions that I'm swimming in it anyway. But why should I swim alone? You know, like, let's listen to others and maybe a good picture can come out of it. Maybe not.
Yes.
But something, some feeling of you're not alone can come out of it, which is really, I think, the best way to start anything creative. It's like,
yes,
you're not alone. Let's hear you out.
Yes, I thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And it's very important that we talk now and that you continue talking with others as part of art making and in general.
I agree.
It's been so interesting. I thought about ending our conversation with the question, and maybe the phrasing is not ideal for now, but the question of what are you most excited about right now and what are you thinking about at this moment?
I think excitement. Every time I say excitement, I'm like, that's also an emotion. We could just say, what are you emotional about right now?
Yes, where are your emotions?
Where are your emotions? I think what I just described, the potential of finding other people around and because I've experienced wars from abroad, unfortunately, a few times, and the loneliness it provokes is deep.
Yes.
And that gives you this feeling of needing to explain and educate the people about what your perspective is and why you're sad and why you're angry and why all these things. And I think thinking about the past 2 days of finding other people that I'm not saying like-minded, even we don't even need to politically agree about anything, but you're affected right now. How are you feeling? Doing something like that, finding something that would have a little bit of a more positive outlook out of this. I don't know if positive outlook is the right phrase, but
there aren't any really right words right now. It's okay to
Everything is wrong, but
it's okay to use whatever words come.
Yeah. So I think it's something for me, it's very, also selfish. What I'm trying to do here is for me to be looking at my computer with something that I am looking forward to working on rather than the news, because I can't, I need, it's not only a distraction, it's dealing with it.
It's surviving it.
Yeah. It's not me going and I'll just go photograph trees now from a specific kind. Not that I'm dissing that. That sounds lovely actually, but, but dealing with all these emotions and seeing that I'm not alone with all these emotions.
Yes.
And having some kind of a mirror of feeling them, not saying that we're all going to hold hands and feel them together and sing kumbaya. That's really not my point. My point is to validate this chaos within all of us. And ideally, I would love it to not only be Israelis that I'm speaking to and also Palestinians. If that would be an opportunity, I would jump on it. But I don't know if that's an opportunity that
right
is
now
available for me right now.
Yes.
Or is the smart thing to do. But ideally, I would like to hear from not just my peers or my people. I don't even know if my people is the right word. My fellow Israelis, you know, it's a conflict with several sides to it. So I don't want it to be one-sided, but right now it feels like a survival mechanism for me.
It's very complex and there's also so many different voices.
Yeah.
And we talked about voice today and I'm just very happy that I got the chance, the opportunity to hear your voice.
Well, I'm happy you came and I could hear yours. Really. We need each other.
Yes, we need each other and these conversations. And we will continue our conversation.
Yes, please.
The listeners of this podcast might not be present at the next conversation.
But we're grateful they came in.
Yes, we're very grateful to you listeners as well. And thank you very much, Ayala.
And thank you, Ota.
Thank you.
This was Artery with Robert Simpkins and Isa Caveggia, a podcast on art, authorship, and anthropology. Thank you for listening. Join us in a fortnight for the next episode in this season on voice and authorship in art.